today, a crossover episode with award-winning podcast Cross Pollination talking about career pivots and EDI. Welcome to Exclusion, a podcast that explores all things equity, diversity, and inclusion in the workplace. Exclusion is brought to you by Canadian Equality Consulting, MBR Consulting. Hello, everyone. It's Marcy and Alicia here. Today's episode is our first crossover podcast, and we're here today with Naima Bayat, host of the Cross Pollination podcast. So this is really exciting, and thank you so much, Naima, for reaching out to us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And we should mention this has been like 6 months plus in the making. Our schedules are not the easiest to coordinate.
COVID schedules. Yeah. So once again, we're recording in dual medium. So this discussion can be found as both an exclusion podcast and a cross-pollination podcast episode. And exclusion also has a YouTube channel. So we will be posting the video on there as well.
And as always, in the spirit of respect, reciprocity, and truth, we acknowledge that this podcast is being recorded on the traditional territories and oral practices of Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta and Region 3 Métis Nation. We acknowledge all nations, Indigenous and non, who live, work, and play on these lands, and to all who assist in their stewardship for generations to come.
So first off, let's explain to all of our listeners what each podcast in general is about. So Naima, if you'd like to start, tell us and our listeners about cross-pollination a bit, and a bit about yourself.
Okay, thanks again so much for having me on. It's great to talk to you both, and it's great to be able to do this kind of double-sided episode. So cross-pollination is a business-focused podcast about innovation and creativity. I chat with guests who've created something new by combining different fields, different skills, and talents. They're typically doing something different than other people in their fields. Some of those people work in companies as entrepreneurs, some work for themselves, some have started their own businesses, or they're combining things that you wouldn't necessarily expect to go together to create something new. Cross-pollination, we're a member of the Alberta Podcast Network, which is sponsored by ATB, and there's a range of different shows on that podcast network. Much to my surprise, last year, Cross-pollination won for Outstanding Business Series at the Canadian Podcast Awards.
Yay, and I try to
Thank you. Thanks. I try to structure each episode so that, you know, what the guest shares in each episode has something useful for the audience to take away, a different way to see things or try out what they can apply in their own lives and in their work. The most fun part for me is getting to talk with a lot of really interesting original guests who've done some pretty cool things like mixing psychology and business, sports, entrepreneurship, social innovation, helping companies draw on the creative resources of their employees. And right now, we're doing a bit of looking at how businesses and individuals are pivoting and innovating their work as a result of the pandemic. In my own background, I studied environmental science for undergrad, then I did grad degrees in international trade and development and an MBA, and I spent a lot of my early career working internationally and then coming back to Canada. I spent a lot of my career also working in the private sector and some public sector organizations that were involved in innovation, doing things in new ways, starting something new and working with startups and with larger companies that are interested in that work. So that's very much what led to a podcast about doing things differently and talking about how creativity and innovation can look in cross-pollinating in different fields, which is inherently about a kind of diversity.
So just to kind of share a little bit about Exclusion for your listeners, Exclusion is a podcast that Alicia and I co-host, and we explore all things equity, diversity, and inclusion in the workplace and beyond. So we want to share positive stories and examples with our listeners of successful EDI initiatives. So that's equity, diversity, and inclusion. And we want to share these so that our listeners can build upon this positive momentum and apply the learnings to their own world and their own workplaces, because we all hear when things go horribly wrong at companies. So for example, the Greta stickers at Xcite Energy Services, or we hear often in the news about rampant sexual harassment or poor board representation and diversity. but we rarely hear what works well. So it's really hard to build upon that and apply that to your own world. So that's what we aim to do. And we always include tangible tools and tips and key actionable takeaways at the end of our episodes for our listeners to be able to implement right away.
What I really love about us chatting with you is that if you want to talk about pivoting, you have three of us right here that are very much have done that within their careers. And I know that that's very similar to a lot of women who, you know, our careers are more jungle gyms versus ladders, where there's quite often a sidestep or lateral move instead of an upward move, for example. Though Marcy and I come from different backgrounds, we've definitely had the opportunity to merge in what we do, which has been quite exciting.
That's very cool. Yeah. So I think we wanted to talk a little bit, and you've touched on it already a little bit about, you know, how we all ended up sitting at the same table, figuratively speaking. And I think part of the reason for us doing this podcast is kind of a collective interest in those EDI topics and why there's value in it in the world of work, which both of our podcasts talk about, and in the podcasting world itself. On my podcast, it's not always kind of a main topic of discussion. It comes up quite often. It often depends on the guest and their focus. But I was interested in talking to you about it from the perspective of how EDI matters for businesses and how it can be drawn on as an asset and an advantage in innovation. I think the fact that diversity benefits innovation is fairly widely known now, but I think it's not always really well known how it can happen and, you know, how to actually translate that into an asset. So, you know, one of the first questions I had for both of you, since you work in this field on a daily basis, is, you know, what does diversity mean to you? Because it means a lot of different things to different people.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question. And Alicia and I, in one of our, I think it was our episode, one of our very first exclusion episodes, we talk about cracking the EDI code and we give a bunch of definitions. But essentially, to me, there's kind of two types of diversity. One is kind of demographic based or identity diversity, which looks at those different demographics or identity factors, right? So sex, gender, sexual diversity, race, ethnicity, culture, language, geographic location, you name it. And it keeps going. And then the other is what Alicia touched on about innovative thought as well, but more in terms of diversity of perspectives. And that includes different life experiences and different opinions and perspectives and thoughts. But that, in my mind, diversity of perspectives kind of stems from identity diversity. So they kind of impact and influence and overlap each other. And that's where I think kind of that innovative thought comes from. So I think, you know, even looking at just demographic-based diversity is a really good first step in order to achieve that.
Well, and I think this ties into, we can get stuck on diversity. And I think that this is a pitfall that some companies have had, is that you can be active in trying to create a diverse workforce. But if you do not actually look at your corporate culture and identify if people of different backgrounds can actually feel like they fit in. So there's a difference between integrating people into your current culture versus allowing them to be included into your culture. So I feel that one of the pitfalls of EDI is we can get stuck on diversity and we just kind of stall there. That there's one thing to have a diverse workforce is very different if those people can be who they are, like really who they are, as opposed to playing a role. And we see this a lot in the STEM world, for example, where we can bring women into a STEM environment, but if they have to act like their male counterparts or only are going to be accepted if they portray those certain features and they can't be themselves, if they have to put on an act in order to work, that's exhausting after a while. And you hear about, like, you know, the, I remember Marcy when we had Leslie Rigg mentioned that it's feathers that, mm-hmm. that pile on each other and that eventually you get a ton of feathers. So a ton is a ton. It doesn't matter if it's feathers or something else. But part of equity, diversity, inclusion is to make sure you create a culture where everybody can feel like they can contribute the best of themselves to it, as opposed to playing a role that isn't them. If you have to leave home in the morning and change who you are in order to go to work, that's not creating the most innovative thought patterns at your company.
Yeah. And just to kind of build on that quickly is, you referenced that, how EDI impacts innovation positively, right? And a lot of the stats that you see talk about diversity, but what they're really studying is inclusion. So, you know, diversity on its own, just looking at the demographics or the numbers of kind of bums you have in chairs and how diverse they are, if people don't feel like they belong, like Alicia said, you won't experience those amazing benefits, right? It's from a culture of inclusion that you get those incredible kind of business case benefits.
Yeah, that really speaks to some of the discussion that's happening now, I think, around psychological safety in the workplace as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how that relates to inclusion and people feeling comfortable being there, being themselves, but also comfortable to speak up and maybe disagree in certain aspects, which is one of the critical things for, you know, innovation to really kind of to get benefits from that diversity of perspectives and opinions and people around the table.
That's something that's really changed, actually, I would say, in the last 5 years, because one of my least favorite books is the Lean In book, because the whole concept of that book is you just have to lean in. If you just lean in, just lean in more, just lean in, just lean in. And so many like marginalized people, women in the workforce will go, how much further do I have to lean in, right? So it's about that difference between putting the onus on the individual to fit as opposed to looking at a more holistic version of a company and realizing, holy, if we don't actually look at this, this can cause mental health issues. This can cause physical issues. If you can't speak up at a company, it creates an environment where it's unsafe. So that there's just been that switch, I would say, in maybe mm-hmm. the last 5 years, to go from putting it on the individual to make change to putting it on a company to actually make the workplace safe enough so that those types of things can actually happen where people can speak up.
Yeah. And just to add, like Alicia and I are strong advocates for there's nothing wrong with you, right? There's nothing wrong with you as a woman or as a racialized person. There's something wrong with the way our workplaces are designed, and they're not designed for you, right? So that systemic identifying those barriers and then knocking those down or mitigating those are what needs to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of structural and systemic stuff around that, you know, in addition to the individual things. Can I ask, what do you do in your work on a daily basis? What does it look like?
Sure. Well, I can start. Lately, I've been working with a lot of other not-for-profits, and we have been designing various policy ideas and taking a gender-based analysis lens at what we could do as a society and corporations, as government, to make sure that after our pandemic, which has very much been putting a big spotlight at some of the pitfalls that we have in our society, how can we pivot that to make sure that we include everyone going forward? So I recently worked with the YWCA to help design some policy, which they're going to put forward to the government. I've worked with some of our professional organizations, whether it be a PEGA or lately it's been CSPG, which is Canadian Society of Petroleum Geologists. I helped them draft a letter after one of our affiliate groups put out a video that was highly sexist and misogynist against female geoscientists. It's hard to believe that that's still happening in this day and age, but it is. So it's sad that we have to keep writing these letters and say that some of these thought patterns are unacceptable, but that's what you do to go forward. So in light that Marcy and I can't necessarily do some of the work that we do within companies, I think she's been able to do a bit more of that than I have since the pandemic. I have found ways to keep myself busy influencing in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Awesome. Yeah. And Alicia and I try to work together as much as we can. So a lot of the work that I do at Canadian Equality Consulting kind of looks like helping and support in terms of recruitment, hiring, and advancement of women or other underrepresented or marginalized populations in the workplace, in any sector, but also in terms of building cultures. So building it that inclusive culture where people feel like they belong and where they can thrive. So a lot of the work I've been kind of focused on is a lot of the in-person trainings that I do have been put on hold. Others, we've been able to pivot and do it online very well. So that's been really positive. Other than that, yeah, a lot of different kind of workplace assessments like pay equity studies, surveying, focus groups, things like that in order to do almost like a gender and diversity audit of a workplace. And then also drafting kind of action plans, things like that. And a lot of the work that I do has been helping kind of private sector, universities or nonprofits meet the new sort of diversity and inclusion requirements that the federal government has placed on different sectors. So as a quick example, in response to the passing of Bill C-69, sex and gender and other identity factors have to be considered in a socioeconomic impact assessment, which is essentially GBA+, like Alicia kind of mentioned a bit. We want to work with companies in order to help them meet these new requirements that are really vague and not clear to them if you're not, you know, in it on a daily basis.
That's a lot of really interesting stuff. And there's lots of stuff I'd like to ask both of you around that. But I know we've got finite time for this podcast as well. So maybe, you know, one of the other questions I wanted to ask you about is, you know, EDI, it's got a business case behind it. It's got a moral case or a moral imperative behind it. You know, there are some people that favor, you know, one approach or the other. You know, what do you think about that?
Sure. I can jump into this first. This is a really important question, and it's something that every sort of EDI practitioner probably spends a lot of time thinking about and strategizing about on, you know, how can I convince people the importance of EDI to make them actually invest and do something in it, right? Or commit to it. The business case, I mean, you know, like you mentioned earlier, I think the majority of people have heard it or understand it a bit, you know, how if you invest in equity, diversity, and inclusion, your profitability goes up, your engagement goes up, your corporate reputation increases, you know, you can collect better data, you have improved communications, you know, I could go on and on and on, all the benefits of it. But what's interesting is the kind of premise behind the business case is that you're hoping that by proving or sharing evidence that this helps, that people will begin to see the value in it or begin to actually recognize that, hey, equality might be important, right? And see the worth in diverse people, right? And the value that they bring to the table, you know, which isn't ideal. And what's interesting, so McKinsey did a recent research study also, I think it was called The Power of Parity. We can put it in the resources section of the podcast. They did a number of interviews across Canada and the US, and they at people in different levels of the company, you know, what would make you commit to advancing EDI? And the most senior level said, oh, the business case would. The business case does. That's the most compelling for me to do something. Middle management kind of said, oh, well, something that streamlines my work and kind of makes it easier. And then junior level employees are like, said the moral imperative or the moral case. So it's interesting that there's that divide. You know, again, you know, we say the business case has been proven time and time again, right? People should be aware of it by now. It's been shared all over the place. Alicia and I talk about it also a lot. Yet there's still more CEOs named John than all female CEOs put together. And there's still poor board representation, you know, and then we're told, like Alicia mentioned, that women need to just lean in more, or you need mentorship, or you need sponsorship, or if you get a few more years experience, you'll advance, or be more assertive, or go to this, you know, a woman's brunch and let's all talk about how we can lean in more, things like that, right? But we don't see it actually changing the culture or the environment. Yeah, what do you think about that, Alicia?
Well, and it's interesting to think about when we say about business case versus moral case, the assumption would be that the moral case is enough, that equity is that we need equity in society in order for everyone to participate, that our long-term goal is equality. To even understand the difference of those definitions, and I would say that before I started working with Marcy, I did a whole master's, and the word equality was actually never mentioned in a lot of the literature that I was looking at, because the definition was wrong, and people didn't like the use of using it. I know even this year, my daughter, she's learning about the justice system in her grade 6 class here in Calgary. And I had to send information to the teachers because they had the definition of equality wrong. Mm-hmm. Equality is not equal treatment. Equality is what we strive for. So to know that we don't even have the definitions right, and to think that we talk a little bit about the concept of gender neutral, for example, that, well, we just have to make our policies gender neutral. The thing is gender's everywhere, and it's important, and we have to address it. And there is no such thing as a gender neutral policy, because we are gendered beings, because that is a spectrum. You can't just make make policy and think that it's not going to affect people differently. So to think that the only way to get through to a company is to talk about their bottom line, that they don't realize that the human capital at their companies is just as important as their capital, is quite shocking sometimes. So, you know, as equity, diversity, and inclusion professionals, we will use the business model in order to try to get attention to it. But it is funny how there's studies that show that male CEOs will not understand the peril of their female employees until they have a daughter, kind of a concept. Like, oh my goodness, what if my daughter gets treated that way? Like, those people didn't matter before you had a daughter. So it is interesting when you work in this profession to see kind of how things change, how things progress, what examples you have to use in order to have people see a different perspective. It makes our work interesting, but challenging. As Marcy always says, we like to meet people where they're at, but first you have to figure out where they're at. Mm-hmm. And people are at very different stages.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd say that, and I like how you shared how, you know, you need to kind of tailor the approach. And I think it also comes down to, and this is really hard to do, but, you know, shifting awareness and raising the consciousness of these individuals. So you're trying to kind of educate them about, you know, that they should care about this, right? And bring stories paired with facts, and hopefully something will resonate there. Yeah. And I find it's, even though the system is broken and like this, the way the workplace is designed is broken essentially and kind of inadequate for all people, you still have to kind of change it from within. So you have to work with it in order to pivot it or change it or shift it. And a lot of those systems need to change, like in the way people are recruited, in the way they're hired, in the way they advance in an organization, even in physically, structurally, and infrastructure, how to change that so it works for, so you have appropriate washrooms or you have appropriate room temperatures or desk heights, things like that, right? It's, you have to get it, you have to change from within and gently raise consciousness kind of in a gentle way, because everything can fall off the rails if someone gets defensive or feels attacked. And that's really easy to do in this world, right? If you're in a position of privilege or you have more power than others, it's really easy to get that feeling. So Alicia and I focus a lot of our attention on, you know, slower change or incremental change, but that's more effective, right? And that'll make the biggest impact. And it may also come down to, you know, Alicia and I have done workshops on unconscious bias, and there's this one particular bias called in-group biases, that if you're in this in-group or this position of power and privilege, you have these innate advantages just because of your identity. And not that I'm saying that all of our current leaders are you know, purely self-interested, but whether they're conscious of that or not, or if it's implicit, there are benefits for the way that the system is currently the status quo that they benefit from, right? So that's why it's so important to kind of raise this consciousness. And that's why people push the business case to say, look, it's good for everyone. But it's also challenging because we're in the business of shifting culture. And our culture is very ingrained in inequality.
It is. And I think it's also challenging in terms of what you've talked about and kind of presenting it as a situation where I think people can often feel more defensive or feel more sensitive about it if they feel like they have something at risk, like they might lose out from promoting more EDI. And that's a really challenging one, I think. Mm-hmm. Just since we're in Canada and we're in Alberta, can you talk maybe a little bit about where we are generally on EDI?
Well, and this is interesting because we're a highly educated province. You would think that in a lot of ways we would be ahead in this, and in some ways we are, but we also have some pretty deep cultural traditions here. And actually, there's a really interesting podcast that actually just came out this month. I wrote it down, the information on it. It's called Alberta Unbound, and it was put together by the independent senator Paula Simmons. And she looks at the underlying culture of Alberta and how this has helped us, how this has hindered us. And one thing that came out of it, specifically from one researcher, Dr. Jared Wesley, he's a political scientist from the U of A. His research has shown how, in general, our province has a masculine undertone, that our persona in itself is masculine. And it's kind of funny because if you talk to female STEM professionals, they'd be like, duh. Like, we could have told you that. Our very femaleness in the industry has been our hindrance. I tell a story about an engineer who mentioned at a conference I was at once that, you know, you go to school, you become an engineer, you go into the industry, and then somewhere along the way, you become a female engineer. She goes, I don't know when that happened. I don't call myself a female engineer. It doesn't change the fact that I know engineering that more than anybody else, but it can show you how an industry, a company in itself, that space can have a gender. And there is a researcher out of Australia called Dr. Dean LaPlante that looks at this quite a bit. And specifically at the resource sector, which is a dominating force, of course, in Alberta, and how the industry itself is masculine. So we talked about that fitting in, that integration versus inclusion. If the industry itself is masculine, then there's certain characteristics that you're only going to fit in if you have those certain characteristics, or you act a certain way, or you are a certain way. And it ties to that safetiness that we just talked about, where if you can't speak up, you don't feel safe. If it's the masculine way is to suck it up, and to go out and work hard and not complain, I can see how danger can come in that. It's crazy how our whole province can have a gender. Mm-hmm. But that is it. And even with the economic recovery that's happening right now, the stimulus packages that are being brought forward, so much of the money is going towards the industries where mostly men work. And so, you know, jobs, 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 we need more jobs. But yet we still see bleeding happening within the public sector, which is highly female dominated. So we lost teachers, not just at the K to 12 level, but also at the university level. I think the statistics just came out that we've lost over almost 4,000 people at our universities here in the province, which could also potentially, I haven't seen the statistics yet, but I have a guess that that's probably pretty female dominant, dominated. This type of gendering can affect all of our decisions. And if we don't do a GBA plus on our policy creation, on even the concept of the red tape reduction, there's been lots of work on that lately where, like, how can we streamline things? Well, there's a reason some of these policies have been put in place, and it's to protect people or to protect certain industries or to protect certain parts of society. And if we don't take a look at that before we get rid of some of these what's calling red tape, we could actually put people in harm's way. So a GBA plus is important on all of our decisions when adding policy, and actually also when taking away policy.
Yeah. And this gendering that Alicia described, and this kind of hyper-masculine culture that we have, also demonstrate in really interesting and terrible ways, with Alberta having one of the highest rates of intimate partner violence in the country, one of the largest wage gaps in the country. Calgary has a higher wage gap than Edmonton, which is interesting because Calgary is very oil and gas dominant, and really that sector is more so prominent here than in Edmonton. Yeah, those are all kind of symptoms of this larger systemic issue. And Alberta has traditionally been kind of viewed as behind other provinces in terms of gender equality because of these really alarming statistics. And for a while, we did have an Alberta Status of Women Ministry, which was really positive. And now it's kind of, you know, it's a lot smaller, and it's grouped in with other ministries and kind of declining its importance, which is kind of sad to see. I mean, it's good to give credit as well to the current government for creating the Human Trafficking Task Force. That's positive, and some of the work that and the money they've given to domestic violence shelters and those supports. But yeah, unfortunately, there's still a long way to go.
What we're seeing in the domestic violence and human trafficking is the consequence, but it stems from a bigger culture that just doesn't, that doesn't exist on its own, right? Like, it's great that we're looking at that, but that's an end member. We have to look at the whole process. And there have been some decisions made lately that I feel were made quickly and without full thought of some of the consequences.
That maybe brings us a little bit to, you know, where we are right now and COVID-19 and the EDI impacts. Where do you think we are right now?
So without going down a full-on rabbit hole on COVID-19, because I know we don't want to make this episode all about that, but there are
definitely could.
Oh yes. There are so many impacts with COVID-19 that aren't being considered, unfortunately. Alicia talked about GBA Plus as well. So just for those that may not be familiar with that, that's Gender-Based Analysis Plus. And essentially that's a tool the federal government uses, every provincial and territorial government in Canada uses, and now cities are adopting it, and so are universities. And it's kind of a really widely accepted positive tool that you can use to apply to your work to determine what your impacts are, who may be negatively impacted or who's positively benefiting from it. And then it allows you to mitigate those negative impacts. And it looks at way more than just gender. So it's called Gender-Based Analysis Plus, but gender is where they recommend you start. But then you look at race, ethnicity, culture, language, geographic location, ability, et cetera, et cetera. So what's nice is the federal government has said that they're applying a GBA Plus lens to COVID-19 responses, which is positive. But that doesn't mean that everything that that analysis reveals is, you know, publicly shared, or that they put money to it, because there's still a lot of gaps that we're seeing. But for instance, we know that through COVID-19, we did a previous episode with the CEO of YWCA Edmonton as well, and with an emergency management professional that looked at gendered impacts. But essentially, you know, women are getting harder hit. Women typically always get harder hit in disasters because they're primarily responsible for the caregiving, the schooling now and all the cleaning now. Women are dropping in Alberta and across Canada out of the workforce even more now. Women are predominantly the workers on the front lines of this pandemic as healthcare workers, but also service sector workers and cashiers and store clerks. People that are racialized are being further marginalized. Lower income people have higher risk of developing it, of COVID. And it's interesting that the stats show more men are dying from COVID, but more women are contracting it, and more women are at higher risk of contracting it. So there's so many gendered impacts that shed such a light on where the gaps are in our system, and give kind of hints and clues as to, you know, what we can do to better respond to COVID-19. And it's not always followed, right? So most emergency management agencies aren't considering gendered impacts at all. And that's just not part of their process. Others are, but because they're an emergency and everything's time sensitive, there's not enough time, or that's the excuse or the reason. I shouldn't say excuse, but the reason why that they've been providing, because I've contacted many of them. And you know, and that's not good enough, because we're going to see terrible impacts of this, and we're not going to be effective in our response if we don't consider, you know, all of the impacts.
Well, and it kind of goes to show you how little we had put into it before, because if fast decisions are being made now without taking this into account, it means it's not common practice for us to think about these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you cause even more harm by quickly making decisions without it being, it's like a muscle, right? Like if you don't use the muscle, you won't be able to strengthen it and use it when you need it. So I find that with our lack of doing it in the past, with our lack of the loss of the Alberta Status Woman is, for example, a huge hit, because that is a department that could be quickly looking at some of these things before decisions are made, just to see if there's something being missed. So I feel like there could be easily put resources into things on a government side that, because we weren't structured that way to begin with, we're missing it now.
And Alicia and I, with our podcast and the things that we recommend, like, we try to be nonpartisan as much as possible. And, you know, we consider all aspects. And it's not that the previous government did everything right with Alberta Status of Women, because they didn't. And there's still lots of gaps. Because I worked at Status of Women, I was one of the people hired to create it. What was interesting is that in the last Fort McMurray fires, we sent people on shifts to the Alberta Emergency Management Agency 24 hours a day to have a physical presence there on the authority of the deputy minister to make sure gendered impacts were considered. Fortunately, changes were made, but it wasn't part of their normal process, so it wasn't sustainable, right? And it was an outsider coming in, kind of ordering people around or shedding light on these impacts, and that people were grudgingly following and not fully understanding, right? So it wasn't sustainable at all, but there were positive things that came out of it, small little things, right? Like adding places for breastfeeding and emergency evacuation centers, having more domestic violence supports at those evacuation centers, having more OBGYNs available and birth control available, because all of that typically isn't, which is quite shocking, right? We have a long way to go.
Absolutely.
That's the theme of everything I'm saying.
Absolutely. And I think that we have to mention that not everyone does everything perfectly. And the reason why we're critical right now is because those are the people that are doing the work right now, is the current government's in place. And no, the previous governments weren't perfect, but like I said, at least they started it. So they started a status woman. That was the first time it ever happened in our province. We didn't have one before that. But then
there was one a really long time ago.
Oh, really?
And then and I think it was enacted in like legislation, like it was to be more permanent. But then I forget. Sorry, I should have looked this up maybe before the podcast, but I'll put a note in our resource section about it. But then it was disbanded. And then over years, it's kind of, you know, fluctuated back and forth and whatnot. But then it was brought back under the last government. Very small budget, with limited impact, but at least those considerations were there. You know, we can debate. I'm sure that, you know, people listening to this podcast have lots of opinions too, but
yeah. But then funding was taken away from it. Not even just the funding that was taken away from the department. As someone who works in the not-for-profit sector, we've saw a lot of momentum happening through granting that was being sent out. And one of the things that we've noticed and we've been quite critical of with Alberta Status Women as of late is that they changed how, this is that red tape reduction thing again, for example. So by eliminating Status Women of having their own granting system, for example, they put it in with the community grants, the gender-based analysis land was taken away. So before, when we could apply for granting to do some of the frontline work, there was consideration looked at gender-based analysis, whereas now there's not. So now there's funding that's being given out that's not, you know, that's being given to the frontline groups, the people that want to do the best work they possibly can. It doesn't mean you're not going to miss something. So the put the gender-based analysis on the granting dollars can be a way to just to pause and to look and to make sure that the efforts that we're going to put forward are going to be the best that they can be with the information that we have at the moment, and as opposed to just a quick throwing money out there into the public.
Mm-hmm. Talking about money and funding kind of gets us also to talking about the recession in Canada more broadly and in Alberta. You know, maybe not a happy topic, but important, definitely. And I know we wanted to talk a bit about the gender impacts. I know we've talked about a little bit of that already, the importance of incorporating EDI during this time for businesses.
Well, I'd like to hear your side of this. I know Marcy and I've done, you've done a really good job of interviewing us, you know, we should ask you, because I know that with the pivot work that you have done, you have probably seen a lot of examples of people pivoting really quickly. And I can say from the work that I've done in the STEM world, how recessions often hit women hard. In the women's groups that I study, you see this over and over again, especially in the STEM professions, where there's a good chance that female STEM professionals are possibly married to another STEM professional versus their male counterparts who may have a stay-at-home parent or something along that lines. So there's quite often, when recessions come female professionals can be the first ones to be let go. And the reason that's given to them is that, well, we have to keep the male breadwinners. So decisions in companies, if you don't do an EDI in, like I said, not just when you create policy, but also when you're doing something like layoffs, you can inadvertently do things without thinking about consequences. So people being let go, not due to merit, but because they have to keep the male breadwinners, so gendering that like that. We've seen that. There's not a lot of statistics on that, but I can tell you over and over again, these women show up at the women's groups. And even the fact that women's groups have to exist, mm-hmm. I would say that the research that I have done has shown that that women are quite often like they have to pivot and they don't know what to do. So these women's groups form not to help them lean in, but to help them actually grieve the fact that they've lost their careers or lost what they had. So I know there was articles even as, it seems like forever ago now in 2018 that showed that after the last recession, the women are the ones that pivoted and they were the ones leading the economic recovery. So will that happen again here? It's hard to know, but I do know that we seem to have that, well, like you mentioned, women are usually in a jungle gym versus a ladder, right? But I don't think it's because they want to be, it's because the way the structures are within companies and within careers, it's just kind of what's thrown on us. So I'd love to hear your thought of some of the people that you've talked to about how they've pivoted and if you mm-hmm. see any trends in kind of like who's pivoting or how they're pivoting and what we can tell others who are in that grieving moment where they've lost their jobs or lost their careers.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And like you say, I think some of this is happening so rapidly and it's still evolving so that, you know, the stats aren't necessarily there conclusively around it. Although, you know, a lot of what you've already alluded to is true. I've heard the recession referred to as a she session.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple of the people that I've talked to early on were sort of career coaches. And interestingly, someone who's written, an author, Diane Mulcahy, who's written a book on the gig economy and her take on that. She's in the States, so the situation in Canada might be slightly different, but I think some of the trends are there is that, you know, this situation is likely to lead to more people working in the gig economy if they weren't already. And, you know, there's a good possibility based on what we've already seen that a large proportion of those people may be women. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be quite interesting in terms of, you know, what that implies for jobs, for wages, for benefits, you know, all of those sorts of things.
Well, and I think that that's interesting what you mentioned there, because to date, the gig economy has not been good at offering benefits and proper work environments. If that's where women are going to end up, it's often that they end up being the ones that are the consultants, regardless if it's a move towards the gig economy or not. And this is something that at AWSM we address all the time. We actually try to go out there and find, for example, a few years ago, we actually worked with Kids and Company and we paid the membership in order for STEM women to have access to childcare. Because when they were losing their jobs in the last recession, the thing that was tied to their jobs was childcare. So when they lost their job, they lost their childcare. So AWSN as a group went and paid for the childcare so that female STEM professionals could even have a place to put their child in order to go to the interview, right? And yes, did they have spouses? Absolutely. But it shows you that gender division of labor, the childcare was tied to the female's job, not necessarily their male counterparts, or maybe they're a single mom, right? So I think, and then the latest thing we've been trying to find is like a Blue Cross type concept for women in STEM, because if you don't have insurance, if you're no longer tied to a company, then that's another expense that comes out of a lower gig economy salary if you now have to try to also have private insurance.
Yeah, it's a complex topic, and I think we're going to see a lot more coming out of this over the coming months and, you know, the rest of this year probably and into next year as well.
No, absolutely. I think that we're going to see more and more things kind of show up. We've, you know, COVID's already showed us the holes in our social systems and in our workplace structure. Like even this sick leave, the fact that if you can't pay your rent unless you go to work, but you're sick, but you don't have sick leave, then you go to work and you get other people sick. You can see how that can be important. Something as simple as a sick leave.
For sure.
One thing that is, I think, kind of positive that came out of it as well is the creating more flexible work environments, which currently doesn't really help that much if there's no childcare and if you happen to have children. But otherwise, just kind of, I heard an interview by Michelle Romano, who's the founder of ClearBank and Dragon's Den. And she said that in the, you know, looking at kind of tech sector projections, that we're already, you know, 10 years ahead of where they thought we would be. So, and that in terms of like everyone using online technology, workplaces. Now, whether or not this stays or sticks, you know, is debatable. For the most part, I hope that flexibility remains, as long as it has those, like Alicia said, those policies and those structures behind it in order to properly support the people in your workplace. But that's something that often a lot of women, when they're surveyed, cite as reasons why they drop out of the workforce, is that lack of flexibility. And so hopefully there's some positive that can come out of it.
Hopefully, I would hope so. Yeah, that's actually one of the things that came up a little bit in that discussion, the episode that I had about the gig economy, and that, you know, a lot of trends and a lot of policies and you know, even legislation around things like benefits and so on kind of tend to lag trends that happen in the real world. So I think that's probably one of the things that we can expect to see, where there, you know, there is more a rise in the gig economy. There may be more flexible work from home arrangements. Less kind of formal work in the way that we've known it so far, but kind of the policies that accommodate those things, like benefits, like childcare, et cetera, you know, they may come along later as, you know, we see a lot more people in those situations and it becomes, you know, those issues kind of attain a higher priority.
I know that there's been a few groups that have tried to help with pivoting, and you may know more than we do. Is there any more groups that are happening out there that we're not aware of?
I think there are a lot of groups that are active in different ways. It's kind of hard to sort of enumerate all of them because, you know, there's a ton of different initiatives. Some of them are happening in more kind of organic ways. Some of them more in kind of organized fashion. Some of the groups that, you know, I think have not worked together in the past are making more of an effort to work together. It's hard to be specific just because there are a lot of different things going on. And like you say, some of them are much more grassroots and others are at a higher level. Some of the companies that I've talked to and certainly individuals that I've talked to that I've been interviewing recently on the podcast, freelancers as well as kind of companies, they're doing a lot of that stuff kind of on their own in terms of their own business and looking at how they can help make their industries or their professions sort of stay viable in the pandemic. And that is a tough thing to do, I think. You know, I see people being very creative, very innovative, doing some really cool and interesting things, looking at, for example, how to make online events more interactive, more engaging, because it seems like, you know, we're going to be looking at those and participating in online events and meetings for quite a while to come. And maybe even pivoting some of those kind of traditionally in-person events online, things that weren't online to begin with. But yeah, those are all kind of very individual sort of company level initiatives. And to some extent that needs to take place. I mean, each individual company needs to think about, you know, how do we work in this new environment? How do we pivot? How do we stay viable exactly from a business sense? But yeah, definitely there is a large role for other organizations, for government, for those kind of higher level organizations to step in and to sort of support those efforts where that's possible.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. And I recently attended this women in business empowerment session, again, a women's group, but it was really good. And with Michelle Romano and Jessica Mulrooney and the founder of Nix, Joanna Griffiths, and Money Expert. But essentially, some of the key themes that came out of that meeting, because it was talking about how you can pivot your business successfully during this time, was around connection, the importance of connection, and the importance of collaboration during this time. So grounding all your efforts into, you know, connecting with others. So your past clients, your consumers or your future customers that you have in mind, and really developing that relationship during this time and asking yourself, how can you better serve them during this time? And what are their unique needs during COVID? And you see a lot of companies now pivoting and making hand sanitizer or delivering meals to people, even if they were a barber or something totally different, just finding ways to stay connected to those, to your core audience. And then also collaborating. So you're seeing some really creative and interesting collaborations come out of this. Photographers are collaborating with restaurant owners, or it's, you know, it's the sky's the limit right now. And it's actually a really exciting time to see some really neat partnerships and collaborations and offers that they're making and working together. And then the other, a big takeaway that came out of that session on how you can effectively pivot is trying to stay in the media. And what all of these kind of, you know, seasoned entrepreneurs recommended, pitch yourself to the media constantly. And they all said that every story that they've ever had in the media they've pitched themselves. So, you know, don't be shy about that. You know, get aggressive with it and get out there and share what you offer. And don't feel guilt over trying to sell right now. You know, if you're trying to serve people and you're doing good, then you know, keep doing it. And we've seen, you know, EDI companies or nonprofits and organizations start offering their training for free during this time, right? Or then normally you have to pay a lot for it, or it's subscription based, and a lot of companies are sharing knowledge and reports and white papers, whatnot, and surveys. Complimentary. And so that's really nice and makes it a lot easier as well to advance and apply this work during this time.
Yeah, that theme of connection and community and collaboration has come up in a lot of the podcast episodes I've done recently as well. Maybe the first one especially was from a career coach who did some of her doctoral work also in the US, but around people who came out of the 2008, 2009 recession and what that looked like, what they did, you know, people who had better outcomes versus people who had less good outcomes. And some of the things that she found were really key were kind of connecting to those broader networks and so on. And one of her key pieces of advice was, you know, this is a time to be bold and to kind of maybe reach out to those kind of what we typically call weak ties and kind of find out, you know, what's going on with them, what's going on in their world, and how can you be helpful with that? That theme has also come up around some of the companies that I've talked to and some of the individuals that are making pivots during the pandemic. You know, one of the companies that I talked to, EventMobi, that typically makes event management software for conferences, usually they would do that at in-person events, but because those type of events, trade shows and so on, have been either canceled or they've moved online, mm-hmm. they've started to develop new products and new features around that. And that's also kind of had them look at new collaborations with other kinds of companies and other groups that they wouldn't normally have worked with in the past. One of the other people that I interviewed is a journalist, freelance journalist and award-winning writer. And, you know, he started something called Pandemic University, which is, well, in his profession, a lot of people in that field have run into challenges in being able to write and publish and kind of do their work right now. They've turned that into an online webinar series that offers professional development for writers, and it creates income for the participating writers who are instructors, also for the Writers Guild, while the pandemic is affecting their livelihoods. And some of the interesting things that have kind of come out of that is a formation of community for that sector. Through that kind of business. And so that's really interesting. It's kind of, maybe a way that they hadn't expected collaboration community to take mm-hmm. place, but it's one of the ways that I think people are being really resourceful and creative around this.
Well, and I find that really interesting because if we're talking about like a gendered work environment, that traditional individualism, siloed worker, the traditional masculinized work environment is not what's thriving right now. It is that collaborative model that in some ways can be referred to as more feminized or a feminine work environment. And it's interesting, like for the not-for-profit that I volunteer with, AWSN, we've always been a network. We've always been a group that's collaborated and shared ideas and we've now realized how our structure has been a strength, and how we can move forward together and share the ideas and share the pain in some ways, mm-hmm. and collaborate and brainstorm. But we already had the structure, whereas we're finding a lot of our fellow not-for-profits, they're having to create what we already have, where they've had to amalgamate or create a structure or work together. Because let's face it, funds are going to be less. Time is going to be less. People's ability to support is going to be less. So we don't need 10 people doing the same thing. We need to all get together and move forward in more of a productive, collaborative way. And so I think that's an interesting concept, where a lot of female professionals, maybe in their work environment, have been trying to do co-working, and they've been trying to push this model for years. It's like, what if we did more of a co-working design? Well, we can't do that. That's not going to work. How do we know you're going to put your effort in? And now everyone's realizing, oh, actually this is collaborative effort is positive. So it's kind of neat to see some of more traditional ways that maybe female STEM professionals or other mm-hmm. professionals work is actually becoming the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for
diversity
sure.
in action.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, because there's been studies that have shown that investing in EDI recession proofs your company. And that not only are you more profitable when times are good, but you're also more profitable when times are bad, and you emerge from the recession stronger and quicker than other companies. And by the way, I should connect with that event Mobi, Naima, because I was planning a GBA Plus conference in the fall that I'm now trying to figure out how could that still be really, you know, engaging online. So. So that's
definitely
good to know.
I'll put you in touch with them. Yeah, it was actually really interesting hearing about some of the work that's going on in that that field, and kind of where things are really on the cutting edge. I actually didn't know that there are some companies that they're not involved in this particular sector, but there are some companies that are almost doing kind of like virtual worlds in the form of conferences, where it's sort of like, you know, a VR walkthrough, almost like a Second Life type concept. Interesting stuff there.
And I think it's going to be interesting this fall, because so many of these conferences are going to go that way, that I hope we don't get like conference fatigue. Mm-hmm. You're going to be a point where I'm done with being in the virtual world. Yeah. I just need to be like, things need to be real again, or I need a break.
Yeah. It's hard to just sit at a computer all day, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, they're definitely aware of that. That's some of the things that I think they're trying to incorporate. And, you know, how do we fight that kind of fatigue?
Great. Yeah. So absolutely. Just to quickly do a time check, how are you guys both doing? Because we're at just about, I think, over an hour.
Well, I think we had one more topic that we were going to talk about, so we can jump into that one. And that was to look at the ecosystem of podcasting in Alberta. I think you're probably a little bit more tuned into that. And I know we've talked a little bit about this offline, about what that looks like now, maybe how we can influence it through EDI going forward. So maybe just give us a breakdown of what you know, and we can talk a little bit about that in an EDI lens.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, there's lots to talk about with podcasting, excuse me, in relation to EDI and separately. I would say, you know, podcasting, one of the benefits of podcasting is that it's, you know, almost anybody with a microphone literally can sit down and produce their own mm-hmm. podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really interesting things that we've seen in podcasting, and I hope to see more of it in Canada, I mean, podcasting, frankly, I think is a bigger thing, say, in the US and in the UK, although it's definitely growing here. There are lots of great Canadian podcasts out there, and great Canadian podcasts in Alberta as well. Is kind of that proliferation and the opportunity for people to get different voices out there. And that's something that I've seen a lot going to podcast conferences in different places, is that people are really seeing this as an opportunity as independent podcasters. If they don't kind of see their interests, their perspectives, or people like themselves represented in kind of more mainstream media forms, podcasting has really become an opportunity for a lot of independent podcasters to get out there and kind of tell those stories, connect with other people with similar interests, similar points of view, and even to kind of create community around that, which I think is really important, especially now, kind of during this pandemic time.
You know more than us, but it seems like in the podcast sector in Alberta, that male persona still seems to dominate.
definitely in the podcast world, I think, you know, the stats are there that, you know, there are a lot more podcasts that are hosted by men than there are women. And so there's definitely kind of a push to get more sort of diversity in podcasting voices out there. I don't know if the stats have gotten a lot more granular in terms of other kinds of voices that, you know, you don't, that are underrepresented, that you don't see or hear quite often. I know sort of on my own show, one of the things that I've tried to do is, you know, have a lot of different kinds of guests on the show, people whose perspectives on business and innovation are not always called on. They're people who are doing really interesting, creative, smart things. They're doing very substantive work, but they're not necessarily always kind of the voices that you hear. Younger people, especially, you know, quite young people are kind of included in that group. So that's something I think that, you know, as podcasters, we can definitely support both by kind of being out there, but also kind of when we have podcast events, podcast meetups, that sort of thing, making it a really kind of inclusive and receptive environment to kind of encourage more different voices to come out and feel like, yeah, you know, you have a place to, you know, say what you have to say. There's, you know, it's as legitimate as anything anyone else has to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's almost like a double-edged sword that it's so accessible. And because almost anyone can do it if you have an iPhone or and a headset. And that's really all you kind of need. You don't even need a fancy microphone. But it's interesting because then it gives the opportunity for people that, you know, are anti-EDI or whatnot to also share their stories, which can be really troubling and dangerous. But at the other end, you know, accessibility is awesome. And it's really cool that all these unique perspectives are being heard that traditionally may not be heard through mainstream media. And Alicia and I, like you, try to put a lot of emphasis on bringing in diverse perspectives and people with diverse backgrounds as much as possible to amplify their stories and be allies to them.
Well, and if there's one thing that podcast I mentioned before, the Alberta Unbound, discussed was, even though our persona as a province may be of the traditional masculine cowboy, for example, that's not necessarily who we are. Which was so interesting about that podcast is that it illustrated that, you know, we are so many things. We are a melting pot in Alberta. Like, there's so many backgrounds and so much influence that we can, background influence and outside influence that we can bring in and be our entrepreneurial self. That entrepreneurial means more than rustic cowboy, right? Mm-hmm. And which I found really interesting. One of the things that they mentioned is the researcher said that he separately had asked two particular young women that he had asked, you know, draw an Albertan, and coincidentally they both had drawn this male cowboy. And for example, and he had asked both these people independently, why did you draw this person? And they said, well, it's my dad. My dad is the Albertan, right? And they say, and he said to her, well, do you have a mom? Yeah. Well, so is she new to Alberta? Oh no, fourth generation. So why didn't you draw her? Well, because Alberta is masculine. But we forget, like, there's so many other people that contribute to our province. And, you know, we have to listen to all those voices. You know, we think of like the famous five. We have statue in downtown Calgary of five women that influenced our province, right? So we would all do better by listening to all the voices in our province and moving forward and knowing that it's not that we don't want to acknowledge our past. It's important, and it influenced us and it still influences us, but to not look at the past and think of that's the only influence that's going to move us forward in the province.
Mm-hmm. It's like selective history, right? Alberta has a history of such amazing entrepreneurial, powerful women coming from it. And we had the first female city councilor, I think one of the first female MLAs even too. Like, we have this incredible trailblazing past. We have one of the highest rates of female entrepreneurship in the country. And that story needs to be told too.
First Muslim mayor.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like,
we're more progressive than we give, I think, outsiders anyway, give us credit for, that's for sure. right?
Right? But like we're a lot of firsts here, but we got to move past the firsts. Mm-hmm.
Let's keep it going.
The word's normalization.
Yes, exactly.
Redefine what normal is kind of part of it, right?
Yeah.
So
for sure.
All right. Well, I think we're definitely coming to the end of our discussion, and which thank you very much. This has been really great to know what you've learned in your podcast, and I hope that we've helped you to learn a little bit more about our background. And if you want to have future guests, who would you be looking for?
Oh, wow. All kinds of different people. People who have created something new, typically by blending, you know, those two or more kind of totally different areas. Those are often kind of the most interesting guests because they've done something really interesting with their careers or in creating that thing. And they can, you know, draw me an email or something like that. I do have to say that for the remainder of the season, the guest slots are a bit booked up, but you know, towards the summer, I'll be looking towards the second season, which starts the third season, actually, which will start in the fall. And hopefully, you know, there's lots of interesting things going on. Looking forward to that.
And we'll post more resources and links in the resources section of our podcast, where you can kind of find the sources that we talked about and learn more about GBA Plus that we've been talking about and links to past episodes of both of our podcasts that we quoted or that are relevant.
Absolutely. And Exclusion can be found in quite a few places such as iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Buzzsprout. And where can we find your podcast?
You can find me at most of those same places with the exception of Buzzsprout. You can also find me on Twitter at Pollinata1 and at crosspollination.co, which is the website address. So please hit subscribe on both of our podcasts if you'd like to be notified when a next episode is released. And we also love it when the audience leaves comments or ratings.
And so you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And are you on social media as well?
I am on all of those platforms, actually not on Facebook, but on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter as well, and also on our website, as I mentioned.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, and until next time, bye.
Bye. Bye.